This is Audible.
Listening Library presents Chasing Vermeer by Blue Balliet. Read for you by Ellen Riley. One can't learn much and also be comfortable. One can't learn much and let anybody else be comfortable. Charles Fort, Wild Talents. About pentominoes and about this story. A set of pentominoes is a mathematical tool consisting of 12 pieces. Each piece is made up of 5 squares that share at least one side. Pentominoes are used by mathematicians around the world to explore ideas about geometry and numbers. Pentominoes are named after letters in the alphabet, although they don't all look exactly like their names. With a little practice, they can be used as puzzle pieces and put together into thousands of different rectangles of many sizes and shapes. This book begins, like a set of pentominoes, with separate pieces. Eventually, they will all come together. Don't be fooled by ideas that seem, at first, to fit easily. Don't be fooled by ideas that don't seem to fit at all. Pentominoes, like people, can surprise you. Chapter 1. 3 Deliveries. On a warm October night in Chicago, 3 deliveries were made in the same neighborhood. A plump tangerine moon had just risen over Lake Michigan. The doorbell had been rung at each place, and an envelope left propped outside. Each front door was opened onto an empty street. Each of the 3 people who lived in those homes lived alone, and each had a hard time falling asleep that night. The same letter went out to all 3. Dear friend, I would like your help in identifying a crime that is now centuries old. This crime has wronged one of the world's greatest painters. As those in positions of authority are not brave enough to correct this error, I have taken it upon myself to reveal the truth. I have chosen you because of your discriminating eye, your intelligence, and your ability to think outside of convention. If you wish to help me, you will be amply rewarded for any risks you take. You may not show this letter to anyone. 2 other people in the world have received this document tonight. Although you may never meet, the 3 of you will work together in ways none of us can predict. If you show this to the authorities, you will most certainly be placing your life in danger. You will know how to respond. I congratulate you on your pursuit of justice. The letter was not signed, and it had no return address. The man had sat down to a late dinner. He liked to read when he ate, and he was on page 4 of a new novel. Book in hand, he answered the door. His spaghetti and meatballs were cold by the time he remembered them. He sat at the table for a long time, looking first at the letter and then out at the moon. Was this a joke? Who would go to the trouble of writing and sending such a letter? It was printed on expensive stationery, the kind you buy if you want to be impressive or pretentious. Should he feel flattered? Suspicious? What did this person want from him? What kind of reward were they talking about? And who was it who knew him well enough to know he'd say yes? A woman tossed and turned in bed, her long hair trapping moonlight against the pillow. She was going over lists of names in her mind. The more she thought, the more agitated she became. She was not amused. Could this be a coincidence? Or was it a clever warning? What exactly did this person know about her past? She finally got up. A cup of hot milk would calm her nerves. She moved carefully in the dark, using the watery rectangles of light that fell across the floor. She wasn't about to turn on the kitchen light. The names scrolled in tidy columns through her mind, each group belonging to a different chapter in her life. There was Milan, there was New York, there was Istanbul. But this was an invitation, not a threat. If things got strange or frightening, she could always change her mind. Or could she? Another woman lay awake under the moon, listening to the wind and the occasional whine of a police siren. This was one of the weirdest coincidences ever. Was this letter insane or inspired? And was she just being gullible, thinking this person was really writing to her? Maybe hundreds of these letters had gone out. Had her name been picked out of a phone book? Fake or not, the letter was intriguing. A centuries-old crime. What could this person be planning? And what about the spooky part? If you show this to the authorities, you will most certainly be placing your life in danger. Maybe this was a maniac, one of those serial killers. She pictured the police going through her apartment and finding the letter, standing over her body and saying, "Geesh, she should have called us first thing. She could have been alive today." A lone cat yowled in the alley below her bedroom, and she jumped, her heart pounding. Sitting up in bed, she shut the window and locked it. How could she not say yes? This was a letter that could alter history. Chapter 2. The Letter is Dead. The letter is dead. It was a strange thing for a teacher to say. By the sixth week of sixth grade, Ms. Hussey still wasn't a disappointment. She had announced on the first day of school that she had no idea what they were going to work on that year, or how. "It all depends on what we get interested in, or what gets interested in us," she had added, as if this was obvious. Calder Pillay was all ears. He had never heard a teacher admit that she didn't know what she was doing. Even better, she was excited about it. Ms. Hussey's classroom was in the middle school building at the university school, in the neighborhood known as Hyde Park. The school sat on the edge of the University of Chicago campus. John Dewey, an unusual professor, had started it a century earlier as an experiment. Dewey believed in doing, in working on relevant projects in order to learn how to think. Calder had always liked the man's appropriate name. Not all teachers at the U, as it was called, still agreed with Dewey's ideas, but Ms. Hussey obviously did. They began the year by arguing about whether writing was the most accurate way to communicate. Petra Andely, who loved to write, said it was. Kids like Calder, who hated it, said it wasn't. What about numbers? What about pictures? What about plain old talking? Ms. Hussey had told them to investigate. They took piles of books out of the library. They found out about cave art in France, about papyrus scrolls in Egypt, about Mayan petroglyphs in Mexico, and about stone tablets from the Middle East. They tried things. They made stamps out of raw potatoes and covered the walls with symbols. They invented a sign language for hands and feet. They communicated for one whole day using nothing but drawings. Now it was almost mid-October. Would they ever study regular subjects like the other classes did? Calder didn't care. What they were doing was real exploration, real thinking, not just finding out about what a bunch of dead, famous grown-ups believed. Ms. Hussey was cool. D-E-A-D. She had written it on the board. They were talking about letters that morning because Calder had groaned about having to write a thank you note and said that it was always a waste of time. No one cared what you put in a letter. Then Ms. Hussey asked if anyone in the class had ever received a truly extraordinary letter. No one had. Ms. Hussey looked very interested. They had ended up with a strange assignment. "Let's see what we can find," Ms. Hussey began. "Ask an adult to tell you about a letter they will never forget. I'm talking about a piece of mail that changed their life. How old were they when they got it? Where were they when they opened it? Do they still have it?" Petra, like Calder, was fascinated by their new teacher. She loved Miss Hussey's questions and her long ponytail and the three rings in each ear. One earring had a small pearl dangling from a moon. Another, a high-heeled shoe the size of a grain of rice. Another, a tiny key. Petra loved how Ms. Hussey listened carefully to the kids' ideas and didn't care about right and wrong answers. She was honest and unpredictable. She was close to perfect. Ms. Hussey suddenly clapped her hands, making Petra jump and setting the little pearl earring into orbit. "I know. Once you find a letter that changed a life, sit down and write me a letter. Write me a letter I won't be able to forget." Petra's mind was already racing. Calder pulled a pentomino piece out of his pocket. It was an L. He grinned. L for letter. This letter was definitely not dead. L was one of the simplest pentomino shapes to use. Most letters, the kind you mailed, were rectangles, he realized. Just like an accurately put together pentomino solution. L was also the 12th letter in the alphabet, and one of the 12 pentominoes. Today was the 12th day of October. Calder's grandmother had once told him that he breathed patterns the way other people breathed air. Calder sighed. If only thoughts didn't have to be broken down into words. Too much talk was hard to listen to, and writing, for him, was a brutal process. So much got left behind. Ms. Hussey ended the class by saying, "Got it? First find, then do. Who knows where this will take us?" Calder and Petra lived on Harper Avenue, a narrow street next to the train line. Their houses were three blocks away from the U school, and three houses away from each other. They often passed on the street, but they had never been friends. Families came from all over to study or teach at the University of Chicago, and many of them lived in this part of Hyde Park. Since most parents worked, young kids traveled on their own around the campus and to and from school. On the afternoon of October 12th, Petra walked home from school with Calder half a block ahead of her. She watched him fish around for his key and open his front door. She knew his pockets were full of puzzle pieces. He sometimes muttered things and always looked like he had just woken up. He was kind of weird. Scuffing through the first fall leaves, Petra drifted into the game she often played with herself. Ask a question that doesn't have an answer. Why was yellow cheerful, she wondered, and why was it always a surprise, even when it came in an ordinary shape, like a lemon or an egg yolk? Picking up a yellow leaf, she held it in front of her face. Maybe she would write to Ms. Hussey about this. She'd ask her if she agreed that humans needed questions more than answers. Calder, at that moment, looked out his front window to see Petra walking by, holding a leaf several inches from her nose. He knew he was kind of weird, but she was exceptionally weird. She was always by herself at school and didn't seem to care. She was quiet when other kids were loud. Plus, she had a fierce triangle of hair that made her look like one of those Egyptian queens. Calder wondered if he was becoming just as much of an oddball. No one had asked him what he was doing after class that day. No one had told him to wait. He'd taken his buddy Tommy's presence for granted. Not now. Tommy Segovia had lived across the street from Calder until this past August. They had been great friends since second grade when Tommy poured his chocolate milk on Calder's bare legs and asked him how it felt. A teacher rushed over, and Calder had explained that it was an experiment and that it felt just perfect. That was the first of many collaborations. He and Tommy had decided back in July that they weren't going to be mediocre kids. They swore that they were going to do something important with their lives, solve a great mystery, or rescue somebody, or be so smart in school that they'd skip grades. That was the same day Calder had received his first set of pentominoes. A cousin in London had sent them as a 12th birthday present, even though Calder's birthday wasn't until the end of the year. The pentominoes were yellow plastic and clacked against the kitchen table in a satisfying, decisive way. Determined, Calder moved the shapes into one combination after another, flipping and turning them. The biggest rectangle he had put together so far was 6 pieces. A breeze was coming in the back door, and some mourning doves that had nested on the back porch were cooing, making that slippery, burbling sound that Calder always associated with summer in his neighborhood. Every detail of that morning with Tommy was strangely clear. At once, Calder had known what to do. The Y had to slide into the U, which had to fit next to the P. He even remembered the sequence of letters, Y-U-P. He had gotten his first 12-piecer and gotten it fast. When he looked up afterward, he saw the pentomino shapes echoed in the kitchen. The hinges on the cabinets were L's. The water faucets were X's. The burners on the stove stood up on neat N legs. Maybe the entire world could be communicated in some kind of pentomino code, kind of like a Morse code. He knew, at that moment, that he would be a great problem solver. Or so he told Tommy, who punched him in the arm and told him he had a swelled head. "Yep," he'd said with a grin. Calder's head didn't feel too swelled these days. He looked at the clock. He was already late. When Tommy moved away, Calder had taken over his job at Powell's Used Books. Calder helped out one afternoon a week now, delivering books in the neighborhood or unloading boxes. With Tommy gone, it was something to do. Calder gulped a glass of chocolate milk, stuffed a cookie in each cheek, and set off at a run. Powell's was one of Petra's favorite places. It was peaceful, and you never knew what you might find. It looked more like a warehouse than a store. Books were piled everywhere, and the rooms were jumbled together in a mismatched way. Although Petra had been inside many times, it always felt like a labyrinth. One dimly lit area led to the next, and suddenly you were back where you started without knowing how you got there. No one asked if you needed help. No one frowned if you read but didn't buy. Petra's mom had sent her to get milk and bread at the grocery store around the corner. Powell's was on the way. Petra had just settled herself on a footstool with a copy of Kidnapped when she saw a long ponytail whip by. Ms. Hussey? Petra stood up carefully. She peeked around the corner, ready to pretend to look surprised. There was no one in sight. Petra looked across rows of cookbooks. She tiptoed carefully through the next room, past English, history, psychology, and pets. She only wanted to see what Ms. Hussey was reading. Darn, the next person she saw was Calder. He was bending over a box of books, a piece of paper in his hand. Don't turn around. Don't you dare turn around, Petra thought. She didn't want anyone from class to see her spying. She tiptoed around the next corner. Miss Hussey was crouched by the art books. Petra couldn't see what she was looking at, but she noticed several paperbacks next to her on the floor. Agatha Christie, Raymond Chandler. Miss Hussey moved suddenly, and Petra jumped backward. To her surprise, Calder was right behind her. He had obviously seen what she was doing. Petra cupped her hand quickly as if to cover his mouth, but stopped before she touched him. They looked equally shocked. Calder, recovering first, peered around the corner. He ducked back in a flash.
She's coming.
It felt too late to do anything but hide, so they hurried out of history and into fiction. Ms. Hussey was at the front desk now. She plopped down her books and began talking to Mr. Watch, the man with red suspenders who was usually at the cash register. They were laughing. Did they know each other?
Can you see what she has? Petra whispered.
Calder walked quickly behind their teacher, his eyes on the counter. Ms. Hussey never turned her head.
Murder and a big art book.
Never something, he muttered to Petra when he returned. Ms. Hussey left the store with her purchases. A moment later, Petra ducked outside, empty-handed, her cheeks burning. She was furious with herself. Powell's had always been her private hideaway, her refuge. Now she'd spoken to Calder there. She'd practically attacked him. And he'd seen her spying on Ms. Hussey. What had she started? Chapter 3. Lost in the Art. 20 minutes later, Petra opened her notebook on the desk in her bedroom. Letters. Think about letters. The 5:38 southbound train went by Petra's window exactly 3 seconds before it passed Calder's. In between, it shot by the Castiglione's and then the Bixby's. Petra had once calculated that it passed a house per second on Harper Avenue. She liked the trains. Looking out, she saw the bright shout of a red hat, a child in a purple jacket pressed against the window, a bald head just rising over a stiff rectangle of newspaper. She'd noticed that colors sometimes left their shapes when things flashed by so fast. She wrote, October 12th, yellow leaf, surprise, loud hat, square coat, bald head like moon, red, lavender, salmon. Question, what does Ms. Hussey really want us to see?
Petra, can you get me some toilet paper? Coming.
Petra sighed heavily and got up to help her younger sister. Petra's household was a tornado where life swirled in noisy circles. Sneakers, books, and backpacks traveled through the rooms on unseen currents, and there was always food underfoot and an old frying pan or two on the steps outside the back door. The cats and dog drank from toilets, having despaired of getting their water bowls filled every morning. And everyone in the family talked to one another at the top of their lungs. Petra wished that things were different. She wished that her parents would sit quietly at dinner and ask her how her day was, and that her 4 younger brothers and sisters would carry tissues with them instead of wiping off rivers of goo on their shirt sleeves in public. She wished she wasn't shy, that she wasn't shaped like a lima bean, and that her left ear didn't stick out farther than her right. She wished she was a famous writer already and didn't have to go through the unfamous stage. She wished her mother wouldn't ever put Baba Ganoush in her lunchbox. When Denise Dodge had towered over her at lunchtime saying,
"Ew, what's that?"
Petra had wanted to murder her on the spot, but only came out with a pathetic,
"Don't you wish you knew?"
As Denise moved away, Petra heard her saying loudly to her friend,
"Blech, aren't you glad you don't have to eat baby gush for lunch?"
The family socks basket was another thing Petra didn't like. She always ended up with one sock either too big or too small. Since no one wanted to sort all the clean socks that went on to 14 feet every morning, the socks went straight from the dryer into a gigantic, hand-woven basket, and it was every person for themselves. Each fall, Petra's mom bought the same color socks for all 7 of them, so that, in theory, there was always a size that fit. But reality in the Andalee family was never that tidy. Like many kids in Hyde Park, Petra was a club sandwich of cultures. Her father, Frank Andalee, had relatives from North Africa and Northern Europe, and her mother, Norma Andalee, was from the Middle East. Petra didn't think much about what racial category she belonged to. Her family had let go of that way of looking at things a long time ago. She did know that for many generations on her mother's side, every first child who was a girl had been named Petra. She also knew that Petra was the name of an ancient stone city in Jordan, a sophisticated and graceful city that had risen out of the desert more than 2,000 years ago. 3/4 of its ruins were still covered with shifting sand. She liked the thought that she was named after a mysterious place of buried secrets. The last first daughter had been her grandmother, who lived in Istanbul now. When she had visited Chicago a couple of years ago, she had told Petra that all of her namesakes had grown up to be very beautiful and very lucky. The younger Petra had looked doubtfully at her grandmother, who just looked whiskery and wispy, and who seemed to spend all day long losing everything she needed, like her slippers or her black eyeliner or even the bathroom. Glamour might have been easier in the past. Petra was sure that every Petra before her hadn't had to put up with thick glasses with blue and purple speckled frames. And every Petra before her probably hadn't had to worry about what she was going to step on first thing in the morning. Dried cranberry juice, or a plastic dragon, or something coughed up by the dog. On her way to get toilet paper, Petra stepped heavily on a headless soldier. Served her right for being so nosy about Ms. Hussey. Then Petra heard her parents arguing downstairs.
"But everyone has something to hide," her dad was saying angrily.
He was a physicist at the university, and Petra knew he'd been worried about his job. She heard her mom say something in an impatient tone, and then the words "letter" and "forgotten," and the quick, harsh sounds of tearing paper. What could this be about? Her parents hardly ever disagreed. A forgotten letter. She wouldn't bring a family secret to school, but she had to look. When she crept downstairs later, however, the garbage was empty. Calder was in a bad mood. The letter assignment felt too hard. How could he ever write Miss Hussey an unforgettable letter? And where was he going to find a stupendous letter now that Grandma Ranjana was gone? Good letters were no longer written. He was sure of it. Calder's dad, Walter Pillay, was slicing eggplant in the kitchen. As he stacked the pale slices neatly next to the frying pan, he looked over at his son. Calder was sketching a fierce column of 5-piece pentomino squares down the margin of his notebook.
"Anything wrong?" asked his dad.
Calder opened his mouth when the 5:38 train went by, rattling the windows, making the floorboards bounce, and filling the kitchen with the whoosh-whoosh of passing steel. As Calder mouthed, "Nope," his dad grinned at him and mouthed back,
"Good."
Calder, like Petra, was a hybrid kid. His dad was from India, and he had a calm way of speaking that made everything sound important. His job had to do with planning gardens for cities. Every year, he brought home a new batch of plants to try out in the yard. By August, the front walk had vanished beneath a tangle of green. This year, a trumpet vine leaned eagerly against a cool lily. Pointy leaves fought to see who could take over the steps. Purples and blood reds argued loudly with each other. It was a good yard for hiding things. Calder's mom, Yvette Pillay, had short hair the color of an apricot and a jingly laugh that made other people laugh even when they didn't know why. She was Canadian and taught math at the university. Calder had never seen either one of them look amazed when they opened the mail. He was suddenly tired of the whole idea. He didn't think he wanted to hear about letters. If he asked his mom and dad, they'd probably tell him too much.
That was the problem with being an only child. Your parents were always paying attention to you. He envied kids whose families forgot about them once in a while. Walking down the block the next morning, Calder stirred the pentominoes in his pocket. He pulled out the pea. Funny, Petra was walking ahead of him. He was beginning to think he had been kind of lame yesterday, following her and then ruining her adventure. He ducked into a driveway and crept through a number of backyards, under a lilac bush, around an old boat, then over two fences. The only way out was a raspberry patch. He dove in, yelped with pain, and burst out on the sidewalk just ahead of Petra.
"Sheesh, you scared me."
"Sorry," he said, pretending to be surprised.
"You scared me, too."
Petra did not look pleased.
"What were you doing?"
"Oh, Tommy and I always used to go to school this way."
Feeling a stinging on his cheek, Calder wiped off some blood. Right. This conversation wasn't going the way he'd planned. They walked in silence for several minutes.
"Heard anything from Tommy?" Petra asked finally,
though she'd hardly said a word to Tommy Segovia in her life.
"Not much."
Calder groped madly for something to say, but everything he thought of sounded stupid. He was going to tell Petra that all the kids in Tommy's new neighborhood had crew cuts, but that was pretty nothing. His pentominoes were making a loud clacking sound.
"Hey, what do you think about Miss Hussey? She's let us do cool stuff so far, don't you think? I mean, cool for school."
Petra, embarrassed by her accidental rhyme, looked sideways at Calder to see if he had noticed. A raspberry twig was standing upright over one of his ears. He looked like a lopsided bee. She was saying dumb stuff, but she hoped Calder would get the message. What happened yesterday in Powell's didn't need to be mentioned. Calder was wondering if Petra had any interest in pentominoes or puzzles. Did she know what was in his pocket? Forget it. He'd sound like he was showing off if he asked her. He noticed that she had a couple of Rice Krispies stuck in her hair, but decided not to say anything about that either. By the time they got to school, both were worn out by trying to think of something to say and trying not to say what they were really thinking. The cold cereal and the twig were still in place as they headed in opposite directions to their lockers. Ms. Hussey had looked strangely pleased when the assignment failed. After 2 days of hunting, no one in the class had come up with anything worth sharing. There were several letters about distant relatives dying, school and job acceptance letters, invitations to weddings. Miss Hussey suggested that they go back a few hundred years.
"Like find old books of letters and stuff?"
Petra asked, thinking of Powell's. There was a wave of grumbling.
"How about paintings? All you have to do is look."
Miss Hussey said she'd noticed that art often showed what was important to people in any given time. It revealed things. Besides, she'd said with a smile, she was tired of being in school all day. It was time for a field trip. Everyone sat up. "Something else," she went on. "Getting an unforgettable letter happens once or twice in a lifetime. Writing an unforgettable letter is a pretty tough thing to do unless you have something very real to say. It shouldn't be artificial. Perhaps I made a mistake." She always said the same thing after she had an idea, and always with an undercurrent of, "We're in this together and it might be dangerous."
"Do you agree? Should we bag the assignment for now?"
There were whistles and cheers. Calder caught Petra's eye, and she shrugged and almost smiled. Everyone looked relieved. This year was beginning to feel either like something was very right or very wrong. It was hard to tell which. On the following Monday, they took the train to the Art Institute and walked several blocks in the October sunshine. It was difficult to keep up with Ms. Hussey's bouncy stride. Calder noticed with approval that she never even looked back to see if everyone was with her. She was one trusting teacher.
After they ate bag lunches next to the bronze lions on the steps of the museum, they fanned out in the European wing. Petra took off on her own. She passed the Degas dancers, the big painting made completely of dots, the Monet haystacks and bridges, and headed into the older works. When she was in third grade, she'd had a babysitter who took her to the Art Institute once a month. The babysitter would sit in front of a painting, sigh a great deal, and sometimes write things down. She'd tell Petra to stay in one area, but not to bother her. Petra would walk around looking. Soon she began to wonder which paintings would be fun to go into, or which ones she might like to take home to her room. She thought about which of the children in the paintings she'd like to play with. Her babysitter gave her a pad and pencil, and Petra made lists. She once counted all the paintings with red clothing in them. Another time, she secretly counted all the bare bottoms. She also counted all the hats and found 123. Now she walked slowly from room to room, hugging her clipboard. She was sure there was a letter somewhere near an angel. Or was it rolled up in someone's hand? They had 1 hour to look, and she knew she'd find something. When Calder saw Petra disappear, he decided to follow her. He stayed a gallery length behind and was so busy trying not to be seen that he barely noticed what was on the walls. Then, quite suddenly, Petra was gone. Calder walked slowly through the next two galleries. It was getting late. He'd better start hunting on his own. Turning a corner, he spotted something promising. It lay on a bedside table inside a French painting by an artist named Auguste Bernard. The date was 1780. Calder looked around. He was alone. He leaned against the wall opposite the painting and began, in a businesslike way, to take notes. The letter was folded up, but had a red wax seal that had been broken. He knew this meant it had been opened. The woman next to the letter was rolling her eyes, and her dress was ridiculously small for the top part of her body. Calder concentrated on the table, which also had a necklace of beads and a book with French words on it. He was copying the words down, L'art d'aime, when the wall behind him moved.
What the?
Calder staggered backward into a dark doorway and stumbled over someone's feet. The person gave him a sharp push. Then the two of them shot back into the brightness of the gallery. A guard strode over and grabbed Calder by the elbow.
Restricted. Can't you read?
Too stunned to answer, Calder twisted around to see who had shoved him.
What were you doing in there? Petra hissed.
How about you? He snapped back.
The guard, a pink and gray sausage of a man, crossed his arms.
Storage room. No public allowed. Where's your school group, anyways?
Calder and Petra walked in silence on either side of the sausage to where Miss Hussey was talking with a group of their classmates.
Here's why she turns into a regular teacher, Calder whispered behind the guard's back.
Petra glanced his way with a twinkle and a quick flash of,
we'll see, won't we?
You in charge. Found these two in a storage room.
Miss Hussey looked surprised, but not shocked. The kids standing around her tittered. Petra and Calder looked grim.
Thank you, Miss Hussey said to the sausage, making it clear that the conversation was over.
When the guard was out of earshot, Miss Hussey smiled warmly at Calder and Petra, looking first at one and then the other.
Good thinking. Find anything?
When Denise changed seats on the train, a scrap of paper floated into Petra's lap.
Calder and Petra lost in the art. First a kiss and then a fart.
Petra brushed it onto the floor, hoping Calder hadn't seen it. Why did kids have to be so stupid sometimes? By the time everyone got off at 57th Street, it was too late to go back to school. Miss Hussey waved goodbye, and Calder and Petra started awkwardly down Harper Avenue.
See ya,
Petra muttered over her shoulder as she hurried ahead and zoomed up her porch steps.
Petra?
What?
Petra turned around.
What were you doing in there?
Just looking. Most museums have too much stuff to have all of it hanging. So if it's not hanging, it's got to be stuck in a closet.
Yeah, I guess. Miss Hussey would have thought that was cool, finding a letter that was off limits,
Calder said.
That's not very nice. You don't like her?
Calder began stirring his pentominoes around in his pocket.
I do.
Petra looked curiously at him.
You're jealous of me.
I am not.
Admit it,
Petra grinned.
Well, just about your storeroom idea.
Petra's face closed.
Of course.
Then she was gone. What had just happened? Calder pulled out one of his pentominoes and tossed it up in the air.
I for idea, he said aloud.
Or was it I for idiot? Chapter 4. Picasso's Lie. Miss Hussey had an extra gleam the next morning. She agreed that the trip to the museum hadn't exactly worked. They'd found three religious scrolls and the letter with the red seal, but that was it. Miss Hussey said she'd enjoyed the search. She didn't seem upset at all.
You know, one of my favorite painters was interested in letters and made them important in a bunch of his paintings. Maybe that's why I thought we'd see more of them. Funny how you can project things.
She changed the subject, her voice suddenly businesslike. So, what now? Have we reached any conclusions about communication? Petra raised her hand.
Maybe that it's hard to study. How about we work on something else to do with art?
She liked exploring the Art Institute. She was sure they could come up with another worthwhile subject to investigate. Denise said,
I thought some of the art was pretty gross. I mean, a lot of it was gory and violent, or fat and naked, or plain old boring. Just people dressed up. I mean, you couldn't make me live with some of those pictures.
There was a murmur of agreement. Denise sniffed happily.
I doubt you'll need to, Denise,
Ms. Hussey said evenly, crossing her arms. Then she stood still and looked at the ceiling. When she didn't move, the room grew quiet.
You know, Ms. Hussey said finally, Picasso said that art is a lie, but a lie that tells the truth.
She was pacing now.
Lies and art. It's an ancient problem. So if we work with art, she said slowly, we'll have to figure out something else first. What makes an object a piece of art?
Denise rolled her eyes, but stayed quiet.
Here's what I want you to do. Start by choosing one item at home that feels like a work of art to you. It can be anything. Don't ask anyone for advice. This has to be your own thinking. Describe this object for us without saying what it is. And this time, I won't let you off the hook,
she grinned.
We'll read some of your ideas aloud.
Calder wondered what Picasso had meant. Was it that art wasn't exactly the real world, but it said something real? He began thinking up other combinations of art, a lie, and the truth that made sense. It worked almost like the logical arrangements of five squares that made up each piece of his set of pentominoes.
How about art is the truth that tells a lie. Maybe all of life was about rearranging a few simple ideas.
Calder, smiling at the chalkboard, now squirmed in his chair with excitement at the thought. If he could just get to those simple ideas, with a little practice, he'd be a cross between Einstein and the mathematician Ramanujan, or maybe Ben Franklin.
Calder?
He was twisted sideways in his chair, his arm resting on his head. His pentominoes had somehow gotten onto his desk. He scooped them hurriedly into his pocket, but one fell to the floor.
Calder, did you want to say something? It looked like your hand was up.
Ms. Hussey said.
I was just thinking, you know, about what Picasso said, but I'm still thinking, he finished.
There was a ripple of unfriendly laughter from the class around him, and Calder could feel the back of his neck getting hot. If only Tommy had been there, he would have elbowed Calder earlier and gotten him back on target. The bell rang. Denise stepped on Calder's pentomino piece just as he reached down to get it. Her knee hit him on the ear.
Oops, sorry, I stepped on your toy.
She laughed and gave the plastic piece under her foot an extra scuff. It shot under Ms. Hussey's desk.
Sorry, your feet are so big,
Calder heard Petra muttering behind him. Not sure he'd heard right, he turned to look for Petra, but she was gone. Calder groped around for his pentomino as his teacher erased the board. He wanted to tell Ms. Hussey that he'd been thinking about important stuff, but he didn't know how to say it. Ms. Hussey turned toward him and smiled.
I know, Calder. I get caught up in my own ideas, too. Maybe one day I'll try having us all write down daydreams for a week and see what we come up with. Maybe we'll decide they're a lot more important than what I thought we were supposed to be working on.
Calder nodded gratefully. Ms. Hussey was the best. As he wiped off his pentomino piece, he looked at the T-shape. T for what? Trouble? But why trouble? There was nothing at home that felt like a piece of art. Petra considered an embroidered pillow, but it had a big tear in it. She found a silk caterpillar kite, but it had lost one eye. She thought of the stick her mom used to make a bun for her hair, the one with amber on it, but it had been missing for days. What was art, anyway? The more she thought about it, the stranger it seemed. What made an invented object special? Why were some man-made things pleasing and others not? Why wasn't a regular mixing bowl or a spoon or a light bulb a piece of art? What made certain objects land in museums and others in the trash? She guessed that most people who went to museums didn't ask that question. They just believed that they were looking at something valuable or beautiful or interesting. They didn't do any hard thinking about it. She wasn't going to be that kind of a person, ever. She thought about pictures at the Art Institute that made her feel as if she could leave everything predictable behind. She always felt that way when she stood in front of Caillebotte's Rainy Day painting. The wet cobblestones underfoot, the people going places in their long skirts and top hats, the inviting turn of the street. This was art that was an adventure. It let her into another world. It made familiar stuff seem mysterious. It sent her back to her life feeling a little different, at least for a few minutes. She was still thinking about Caillebotte's Paris street on her way to the grocery store. If he had painted Harper Avenue, would it have looked just as intriguing? As she approached the corner, she noticed the man with suspenders, the one who had talked to Ms. Hussey, step out the front door of Powell's, look around, and drop a book into the giveaway box outside. She sped up. The book had a cloth cover with several dark stains, and the paper was thick and creamy, soft at the edges. The title jumped out at her. Low. The illustrations were done in black and white. Distorted, rubbery figures clutched each other or screamed. She read a few paragraphs. Terrified horses, up on their hind legs, hoofing a storm of frogs. Frenzied springboks, capering their exasperations against frogs that were tickling them. Storekeepers in London, gaping at frogs that were tapping on their window panes. We shall pick up an existence by its frogs. Wise men have tried other ways. They have tried to understand our state of being by grasping at its stars, or its arts, or its economics. But if there is an underlying oneness of all things, it does not matter where we begin, whether with stars, or laws of supply and demand, or frogs, or Napoleon Bonaparte. One measures a circle, beginning anywhere. I have collected 294 records of showers of living things.
What? Petra flipped back to the front and saw that the book had been written in 1931 by a man named Charles Fort. She tucked it under her arm.
Chapter 5. Worms, Snakes, and Periwinkles. That night, flipping around in low, Petra was more and more amazed. She had never seen a book like this. It was, first of all, peppered with quotes from journals and newspapers around the world. There was the London Times, the Quebec Daily Mercury, the New Zealand Times, the Woodbury Daily Times, the New York American, the Gentleman's Magazine, the Salem Observer. The list went on and on. There were hundreds of stories of bizarre happenings, many of them similar. Venomous snakes dropped into backyards in Oxfordshire, England. Red and brown worms fell with snowflakes in Sweden. Bushels of periwinkles fell from the sky on Cromer Gardens Road outside Worcester, England. Luminous floating lights traveled slowly over open land in North Carolina and in Norfolk, England. Wild animals turned up where they shouldn't have. People disappeared and then were found far away, disoriented and confused. There were crashes and explosions that no one could explain. Fort had apparently spent 27 years going through old newspapers in libraries. He had copied out thousands of articles about unexplained goings-on. It is the profound conviction of most of us that there never has been a shower of living things. But some of us have been educated by surprises out of much that we were absolutely sure of. Petra read this twice and turned a few pages. I have never heard of any standard in any religion, philosophy, science, or complication of household affairs that could not be made to fit any requirement. We fit standards to judgments, or break any law that it pleases us to break. We have conclusions, which are the products of senility or incompetence or credulity, and then argue from them to premises. We forget this process, and then argue from the premises, thinking we began there. Petra struggled with this language and had to look up the words credulity and premises. Rereading each sentence in pieces, she began to get a grip on what Fort was saying. Depending on how you looked at things, your world could change completely. His thought was that most people bent over backward to fit everything that happened to them into something they could understand. In other words, people sometimes twisted what was actually in front of them to fit what they thought should be there, never even realizing they were doing it. People liked to see what they were supposed to see and find what they were supposed to find. It was quite an idea. And then, see London newspapers, August 18th and 19th, 1921. Innumerable little frogs that appeared during a thunderstorm upon the 17th in the streets of the northern part of London. Farther down, there have been repetitions of these arrivals. There is an account in the London Daily News, September 5th, 1922, of little toads which for 2 days had been dropping from the sky at Chalons-sur-Saône, France. Could this be true? Why wasn't more time in school spent studying things that were unknown or not understood, instead of things that had already been discovered and explained? Miss Hussey always asked for their ideas. Wouldn't it be great to go digging for weird facts like Charles Fort did? To try to piece together a meaning behind events that didn't seem to fit? And why wasn't this book a piece of art? She grabbed her notebook and began to write. This object is hard on the outside and bendable on the inside. It is the color of an unripe raspberry, and it weighs about as much as a pair of blue jeans. It smells like a closet in an old house, and it is an ancient shape. It holds things that are hard to believe. There are living creatures falling like rain, and objects that float by themselves. People vanish and reappear. It is made of substances that once grew, that once bent in the wind and felt the night air. It is older than trips to the moon, or computers, or stereo systems, or television. Our grandparents might have seen it new when they were young. There was a woman's name in faded brown ink inside the cover. Petra wondered who else had loved this book and why it had ended up outside Powell's. Why had it been thrown away? She would never lose it. Not ever. Before closing the book, she looked again for that one terrific sentence. "We shall pick up an existence by its frogs." Hours later, under a sliver of moon, Petra was almost asleep. As she rolled over, squashing her pillow into position on top of her arm, a strange thing happened. Although her eyes were closed, she seemed to be looking at a young woman. This person was old-fashioned. She was dressed in a yellow jacket that had dappled fur on the edges, and her hair was pulled back tightly with shiny ribbons. Dangly earrings, perhaps pearls, caught the light. She had been sitting at a table and writing. Something had interrupted her. Quill pen in hand, she had paused to look up. The woman was gazing directly into Petra's eyes. Her expression was knowing, filled with kindness and interest, and she had the look of someone who understood without being told. Petra found herself soaking up every detail of the image. Although the room was dark, light touched the metal fastenings on a wooden box, a fold of blue cloth on the table, the curve of the woman's forehead, the creamy lemon of her jacket. This was a calm, deliberate world, a world where dreams were real, and each syllable held the light like a pearl. It was a writer's world, and Petra was inside it. And then, as suddenly as she had appeared, the woman began to fade from Petra's mind. As this happened, Petra felt recognized, as if this person knew who she, Petra Andely, was. It was a shocking feeling, exhilarating, shivery, true, and somehow inevitable, as if things had always been this way. Wide awake now, Petra thought of Charles Fort. Was he responsible for the woman's visit? Had he brought them together? Educated by surprises. Fort understood what Petra had often felt. There is much more to be uncovered about the world than most people think. If she'd had any idea how much more, Petra wouldn't have slept at all that night. Chapter 6, The Geographer's Box. On the day Ms. Hussey had given the art assignment, Calder went straight up to his room after school. He sat down at his desk and pulled out his pentominoes. The W fit with the Y and the U, and the I slid in agreeably next to the L. The X was difficult to work into the rectangle, but it might fit here between the P and the U. Pentominoes always helped him think. He wrote down the word A-R-T. He followed it quickly with R-T-A, R-A-T, A-T-R, T-R-A. It wasn't what he'd meant to put on his list, but his pencil kind of took charge. He read what he'd written aloud. It was a tongue twister, he noticed with delight, aside from being every combination of A, R, and T. Calder shook himself back toward the assignment. Was his weird list a piece of art? How about the old-fashioned kind of art, the kind in museums that turned up